Penguin Random House Audio presents Mrs. Osmond by John Banville. Read for you by Amy Finnegan.
Deep in her soul, deeper than any appetite for renunciation, was the sense that life would be her business for a long time to come. Henry James, The Portrait of a Lady. Part 1. Chapter 1. It had been a day of agitations and alarms, of smoke and steam and grit. Even yet she felt, did Mrs. Osmond, the awful surge and rhythm of the train's wheels beating on and on within her. It was as if she were still seated at the carriage window, as she had sat for what seemed impossibly many hours, gazing with unseeing eyes upon the placid English countryside flowing away from her endlessly in all the soft green splendor of the early summer afternoon. Her thoughts had sped along with the speeding train, but, unlike the train, to no end. Indeed, she had never registered so acutely the mind's unstoppable, senseless, headlong rush as she had since leaving Gardencourt. The great snorting and smoking brute that had paused with brusque impatience at the meek little village station and suffered her to take her place in one of its lattermost compartments, her fingertips still retained the impression of hot plush and greasy leather, now stood gasping after its mighty efforts under the high, soot-blackened glass canopy of the throbbing terminus, disgorging onto the platform its complement of dazed, bedraggled travelers and their jumbles of baggage. Well, she told herself, she had arrived somewhere, at least. Staines, her maid, had hardly stepped down from the train before she flew into an altercation with a red-faced railway porter. Had she not been a female, it might have been said of Staines that she was a fellow with a heart of oak. She was tall and gaunt, a person all of angles, with long wrists and large feet, and a jaw that put one in mind of the blade of a primitive axe. In the years that she had been in Mrs. Osmond's employ, or given how closely they were conjoined, better say, in the years that they had been together, Staines's devotion to her mistress had not wavered by a jot. In their long period of exile in the South, her forbearance had extended to putting up with the Italian market and the Italian kitchen, and, which required an even more saintly fortitude, with Italian plumbing. Indeed, such was her steadfastness that on occasion Mrs. Osmond, Isabel, found herself longing wistfully for even half a day's respite from her servant's unrelenting, stone-hard solicitude. In their recent travels together, the chief token and proof of Staines's loyalty had been a permanently maintained state of vexedness, not only in face of the impudence of porters, cab drivers, boot boys, and the like, but also against what she considered her mistress's willful credulousness, deplorable gullibility, and incurably soft heart. Now, as the maid, her bonnet fairly wagging from the force of her indignation, stood berating the porter for unspecified shortcomings, as a Londoner she was exercising her right to quarrel with her own kind in her own city, Isabel moved away with that wide-eyed blandness of manner she had perfected over the years at the scenes of so many similar confrontations between Staines's will and the world's recalcitrance. She longed for the hotel and its stilly breathing, cool and shadowed spaces, in which she might sit perfectly immobile for a long time and let her reeling mind run down of its own accord. She would rest if only she could stop thinking, but how to effect that marvelous trick? The death of her cousin Ralph Touchett on a recent eve in his mother's house at Gardencourt. Extraordinary to reflect that there had been an exact, measurable moment, marked by a click on the clock, when for him eternity had begun, had left her with a hard task to solve, like an exercise in geometry or algebra. The solution she was required to derive was no more or less than to find a fit mode by which to mourn the young man's passing. In truth, her cousin could no longer have been described as young, but that was how she thought of him, and no doubt how she would think of him always. Perhaps that was the main part of her difficulty, that it seemed a scandal to shed tears for a person whose life had been so marked by the slow vastation of a wasting illness that he could hardly have been said to have had a life at all. Thinking this, she at once chided herself. Who was she to judge the quality of any life, however brief or burdened? Behind the chidden thought, however, lay a darker, irrepressible formulation, which was that the intensest living Ralph had done, he had done through her, by way of a passionate vicariousness, watching in smiling wonderment from his seat at the ringside her breathtaking flights, her spangled swoopings to and fro in the powdery light high up, oh, so high up, under the big, the tremendous top. To have lived through someone else, even someone he professed to adore, that had been the height of Ralph's triumph and the depth of his failure. How she wished now she had been capable of that greatness he had hoped for in her, those loftier leaps, those ever more graceful pirouettes in midair, those weightless landings on one braced toe, those sweeping bows with swan's neck arms widespread. If she had lifted him up, she had also let him down. What he could not have expected, what he could not have imagined possible for one so firmly balanced as she, was the great, the catastrophic plunge from airy heights that had been precipitated by her marrying the perfectly wrong person. Behind her now, she heard an unmistakably solid step, and a moment later, Staines loomed at her shoulder, her scant plumage ruffled and crackling, and she readied herself for the inevitable rebuke. "Why, there you are, Mum," the maid said loudly, for she had a voice as large and forceful as the rest of her. "I was looking for you everywheres among all this pushing and pulling crowd." "I merely walked on," Isabel mildly protested, offering a mitigating smile. Staines, however, was in no mood to be mollified, and her mistress waited, almost with interest, to know how she herself should be implicated in that recent struggle on the platform, of which she had experienced no more than a hard glare from the porter's soiled eye and a muffled oath directed at her departing back.
"The gall of that fella," the maid said now, puffing out her cheeks in the way she did when she was wroth. "Well, he got a piece of my mind, I can tell you."
Here she made a marked pause as she notched the barb to her bowstring, and when she resumed, it was in a tone seemingly more of regret than reproval.
"Of course, if he'd have known you was in mourning, I have no doubt you would have presented a very different attitude."
This time, Isabel reserved her smile to herself. The maid's veiled yet pointed reference was to the dispute she and her mistress had engaged in before departing Garden Court over the matter of a mourning band, a dispute in which, unusually, the more determined of the two combatants had been forced to concede. It was, to all intents, a perfectly acceptable circlet of black crepe that the servant had proffered, with a matchingly solemn mien, and it was a question as to which of them had been the more surprised when Isabel had declined, politely but firmly, to allow it to be pinned high up about the upper sleeve of her traveling coat. After a second of shocked silence, the maid had begun to remonstrate, but her remonstrances proved to no avail. It was one of those instances, few but momentous, when the mistress showed her steel and the maid prudently stepped back. Mrs. Osmond would not wear a mourning band, and that, incontestably, was that. Staines had sulked, of course, and had bided her time until now, when her mistress's flashing blade was safely back in its scabbard and she could risk a retributive shot.
"Yes, I'm sure," she said, with a sort of toss of the head in her tone. "I'm sure even a ruffian of his sort would have shown a bit of respect for a person's loss, if he'd only have been able to see the evidence of it."
To this, Isabel did not respond. She had found, over the years, that a remote and unemphatic silence was often the most effective counter to her maid's insinuative provocations. In truth, she was not certain herself why she had refused, to the point of vehemence, to have the thing on her sleeve. Perhaps it was that to her it would have been somehow to claim too much to make such publicity of her sorrow, that it would have been a breach of common decency, a breach even of common modesty. On the other hand,
She was sure Ralph himself would be only too delighted to behold her draped from top to toe in black bombazine.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?